From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Inspector Rex is the nickname that Nick Xenophon once gave Rex Patrick due to Patrick's reputation for undertaking fact-finding missions. Senator Patrick currently has a case before the Administrative Appeals Tribunal in which he's attempting to have the minutes of National Cabinet released to the public. And he's also pushing for reform that would promote government transparency by making it easier to get material under the Freedom of Information law. But his interests aren't confined to government accountability and transparency. A former submariner with the Royal Australian Navy, Patrick has been very outspoken on the project to build Australia's new submarine fleet with a French company contracted to construct them in Adelaide. Projected to cost a huge $89 billion, the project aims to deliver 12 new submarines for the Navy. Patrick criticises the program as not being on budget, not being on time, and not good enough to establish Australia's sovereign capability in this area. Rex Patrick joins the podcast today to discuss the progress of his court case, his wider transparency agenda, and exactly what the government should be doing about those submarines. Rex Patrick, let's start with your quest for more accountability from government, more information about government. One of the big decisions of the pandemic in terms of the way government operates was the setting up of the National Cabinet of federal and state leaders. But this has been treated like any other cabinet, which is very convenient, especially for the federal government, with the documents and the deliberations all confidential. You're trying to bust this open. Can you tell us something of what you've done, where it's up to, and what you hope to get if you succeed?
Well, thank you, Michelle. Look, the starting principle here is that everything the government does, it does on your coin and for public purpose. And only in exceptional circumstances should the public be excluded from having access to information. We have a right to participate, to try and influence, to criticise, to congratulate a government in relation to the things that they're doing. And that's the way a responsible system of government works. And the difficulty I have, particularly in the wake of the pandemic, is that the Prime Minister set up a committee that he called a National Cabinet and tried to wrap a secrecy blanket, or in fact did wrap a secrecy blanket, over everything that it discussed. And the things that he was discussing were matters relating to projections as to how the pandemic will play out, vaccine strategies, what is a hotspot, what is the right response, do we lock down our cities, do we send children to school, do we close our borders. Now, all of those sorts of issues are not issues of national security. We're not talking about how deep a submarine goes or how fast a jet fighter may fly. These are matters of extreme interest to the public. And when decisions are made about these sorts of things, particularly decisions that restrict liberties, we ought to be able to see the reasoning and all of the discussion that takes place that leads to these decisions. Now, unfortunately, the Prime Minister, by adopting the cabinet conventions, pretty much barred the access to anything that occurred. And the cabinet exemption is one under Freedom of Information laws that is that goes to a class of documents rather than the content of the documents. So even if the words were in the National Cabinet, it was discussed whether or not Scott Morrison had a dog or not. Because it's a cabinet document, it can't be disclosed. So it's an abuse of power, in my view, because the cabinet as he has constructed it is not in fact a cabinet, and the operation of the national cabinet doesn't conform with the rules of cabinet. And so in effect, it's an abuse, and it's an abuse upon the public who have a right to know.
So where is your quest to get access up to, and what do you think you might get out of these documents if you can get them?
Well, once was initiated an FOI, and a Freedom of Information request, and I didn't necessarily want any particular information rather than to open the vault. Basically, a precedence whereby National Cabinet was deemed by a judicial officer of some sort to be a National Cabinet, such that anyone could then go and seek access to the deliberations, the submissions and the decisions of the Cabinet, so that we could look closely at what decisions had been made and what decisions had been made. So I made a request for access to the minutes and the notes of Cabinet, knowing basically taking the issue face on. Of course, the government denied me access under Freedom of Information laws, saying that it was cabinet in confidence. It expected and took that to the Infomissioner, who's the sort of next level of appeal from that, with Justice White determining that National Cabinet is in fact just an intergovernmental body.
No timing of the decision yet, though.
Justice White recognised the importance of the decision and did indicate that he would be quick in making it. I expect something within the month.
Just on the question of freedom of information, which you've mentioned, that legislation, what sort of reform do you think should be undertaken of the FOI legislation? Because a lot of individuals and certainly media find that they don't get much information and there are delays and costs and so on.
The very starting point with FOI is that members of the public have a right to access. Only in circumstances where there is a proper exemption can access to documents be denied. Unfortunately, officials tend to be very apprehensive, very cavalier in the way in which they apply exemptions. And basically, in my view, and I can't say this from anything definitive, but from my own experience of having run many, many FOI matters, basically what they do is they put up exemptions knowing that they will wear you down. The exemptions may not eventually stand, but most people will give up. A lot of people give up at first instance. They just accept the decision that it's not releasable under FOI. People like me, I always take the government on when I think they've made an incorrect decision. And in actual fact, in my circumstances, I've had 10 appeals and 10 wins. If you're persistent, you can get there. But one of the problems, of course, is sometimes by the time you get there, the information is no longer useful. And that in itself can be a strategy of government. A delay is the enemy of FOI, and governments are expert at putting barriers up to stop people getting access to information. So the FOI laws need to be changed to do things like place timeframes around the Information Commissioner when she makes decisions in reviewing an agency. Currently, there is no time restrictions, and sometimes she is taking more than 2 years to make a finding. I've got matters with the Information Commissioner that are more than 2 years and 9 months old, and one wonders when you get access to the information whether it has any relevance at all. So we need to wrap some timeframes around them. Other things we need to do is make it so that that the government is consistent in the exemptions it claims. What it can do is make an exemption such as its cabinet in confidence or its legally its legal professional privilege in terms of the information that is sitting underneath a document. Then as it advances through a review process and it looks like they're going to lose on those exemptions, they then introduce new exemptions. And I think there has to be a constraint on that, because that in effect causes the FOI applicant to start again with the government, because they've got a whole new suite of arguments that they put up. And that's not helpful either. We need to have a situation where the information commissioner has supporting commissioners. So under the Australian Information Commissioners Act, there are supposed to be three commissioners: an information commissioner, a privacy commissioner, and an FOI commissioner. Since 2014, there hasn't been an FOI commissioner, and the information commissioner has filled the role of both information commissioner and privacy commissioner. We need three independent commissioners, and I'm actually quite pleased that the government has bowed to the pressure that I've been putting on them to actually now appoint a new FOI commissioner. So for the first time in 7 years, we'll end up with an FOI commissioner.
Sounds as though you've been doing some of that wearing down that you say comes from the other end of the process. But you've been talking about officials. I wonder whether, in fact, really officials are just protecting ministers and acting at the behest of ministers, or what they anticipate would be the behest of ministers.
There's no question that the culture of secrecy is led from the top. And that starts with the Prime Minister, and we go back to his claim in terms of national cabinet, where he says, no one is entitled to see what we are talking about by creating this entity and extending it to for example, the AHPPC, the doctors that are supposed to be advising government. Nowhere in the history of cabinet did cabinet apply to meetings of doctors. It was always meetings of senior ministers, yet that's what he did under the national cabinet regime. And that meant even in Senate committees, whenever anything came up that had an aroma of national cabinet about it, officials just said, no, we can't tell you that information. And then you'll see right down the chain, people looking up and saying the government has a culture of secrecy, and we will comply with that culture. That's in actual fact what happens. One of the reasons we end up with lots and lots of FOI commissioner applications or reviews with the information commissioner is because the department are making wrongful decisions, and they're making more and more of them as they become more and more cavalier, basically pandering to the will of very senior members of government.
Well, while we're talking about the Prime Minister, let me change to a very different topic, but one involving the Prime Minister. When he is in France on the G7 trip, after the G7 meeting, he will have discussions about Australia's submarine program and contract with the French builders of it. You're a submariner yourself. You've taken a lot of interest in what's been a very controversial decision about our future submarines. Where do you think things are up to, and what should be done now with this rather vexed program?
So you're right, I am a former submariner, and it's for that reason I'm probably the most submarine enthusiastic parliamentarian that we have. But I am gravely concerned about this particular program. Firstly, it is a most expensive program. It was $50 billion for 12 submarines, and that was expensive, but it's now gone up to $89 billion. That's a $39 billion increase in price. Most people have no idea what $39 billion is conceptually, but it's $39,000 million. That's just an awful blowout in cost that has almost gone unnoticed. As I argue in Parliament about, maintaining low cost for university degrees, that where the government's trying to save $1 billion, over on the other side of the lake in Canberra, the Defence Department is just blowing away almost $40 billion. So cost is a big issue. Secondly, we know that each of the major milestones that have occurred thus far have not met schedule. So we know that it is behind schedule. We also know that it may not deliver a regionally superior submarine as originally intended. In evidence given to the Senate, the Navy has conceded that these future submarines, at least the first of them, will not have lithium-ion batteries. They'll have lead-acid batteries. Now, I put it to your listeners that the only place you will find lead-acid batteries in 2035 will be firstly on our future submarine and secondly in a museum. So there are considerable concerns that we will actually achieve a regionally superior submarine capability. And finally, the program hasn't met expectations in terms of the amount of Australian industry content and involvement in the program. It was an objective of this program to build a sovereign shipbuilding capability and a sovereign sustainment capability, meaning that when we reach the unfortunate situation where these submarines have to be used, that we have the ability in country to sustain them and to deal with any particular issues that may arise in the course of a conflict. And that is not happening. So the project is going wrong in so many different ways that we do need to have a plan B and indeed not just have a plan B, but be giving active consideration to switching to it. If I look at the total cost of $89 billion and say that when we get to 2035, which is when these submarines are due, if there's a 10% blowout, that's $9 billion. It may be better at this stage to simply pay the exit fee, walk away from the contract and go to something that's far less risky and far less expensive that delivers, you know, almost the same capability.
So is that the message that the Prime Minister should be delivering when he goes to France?
I think he should be calling out the project's situation exactly as I have described it, and making it very clear to the President that the government will walk away from this if there is not a substantial change in the way in which the program is being conducted.
So there should be an ultimatum, you're saying, to President Macron?
Absolutely. Despite the good relationship we may have with France, this is a matter of national security, and it's also a matter of a huge amount of public expenditure, and the Prime Minister must put the Australian public before that relationship. I think it would be wise for him to be just very frank and honest with the French President.
Now, let me just finish with something of your own experience as a backbencher. You came originally from the Nick Xenophon team. You went out on your own then as an independent. You're contesting the next election, aren't you?
I am.
And obviously that will be an immense challenge to survive. And on the history, it will be hard to get enough votes. So you might be in your last year of being a parliamentarian. How much influence do you think you've been able to have and are able to have as a crossbencher, and how do you see the future for you?
Look, I'm very proud of all of the things that I've done in the parliament. They range from getting security costs in regional airports made much, much more reasonable to the amending of legislation where I think we've got much better outcomes. Even at a personal level, I've managed to get visas for people who, you know, deserve those visas. There's a whole range of things that I've done in my term in the Senate that I think were very 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 useful. And look, my own team would describe me as a workaholic. If anything, I probably any regrets I have is that maybe I haven't worked hard enough, maybe I haven't squeezed everything out of that I possibly could have. But moving forward, you're right, it is a challenge. You know, generally, what you're up against when you go to an election are well-branded parties such as the Liberal Party, the Labor Party, the Greens, and you have to end up standing out in some way. Is the case with Nick Xenophon or Pauline Hanson or Jackie Lambie. It's hard. It's going to be hard to get across the line. I'm going to try, and I hope people recognise the work that I've done, whether it be in transparency, whether it be on the Murray-Darling, whether it be on manufacturing, whether it be on the environment, all of those sorts of things. I'm hopeful people will have noticed what I've done, but there's no guarantees. A lot of people are not politically engaged, and they turn up to the polling booth and they vote the way their parents may have, or they vote on a brand, and that is indeed a challenge for me. Look, I've described my pursuit of re-election as, climbing Mount Everest with a crutch and no oxygen. It's a hard task, but I'm going to go for it.
There'll be a tough year ahead. Rex Patrick, thank you very much for talking with the Conversations Politics podcast. That's all for today. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview soon. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.